You're listening to a Why Now podcast.
This is the Worldwide Will Show on whynow.co.uk. I'm your host, Will. I'm a British Army veteran of just short of 11 years and served numerous tours of Afghanistan. In this show, I'll be speaking to former members of the British Armed Forces and Coalition Forces, giving them a platform of which to tell their life story, as well as experiences and how it's affected them. I hope you enjoy the show. Welcome to the Worldwide Will Show. I'm joined by
Roy Thorburn.
Thank you, brother. Thank you for coming along.
Thanks for having me.
No worries, no worries at all. Basically, this podcast is to basically tell people's lives in a story, because everyone's life is a story, and I believe it's down to them to tell that story. So why not invite them on? Roy, where did it start, and when did it start?
Well, where did it start? It started in the southwest Scotland. I was born in Dumfries. I've got a family of five, so I've got an older sister, Kay, a younger sister, Danny. They're both nurses for the NHS.
Are they the ones on Facebook friends with?
Yeah, they're the ones that you probably pest on.
I'm only joking. If Lauren's listening, I'm joking.
No, it's all right. I've got an older brother, Kyle, two older brothers, actually. So I've got Kyle, who served in Wampara.
Yeah.
And also I've got another brother, Sean, who served in Tupara. They are both out now. Mm-hmm. Kyle runs his own security firm in Romania. He's a training provider.
Yeah.
And Sean is a self-employed builder in Edinburgh.
Brilliant.
So, yeah.
So all three boys, fucking reg.
All three of us joined the paras. I went to a school in Lockerbie Academy. Mm-hmm. And then from there, I joined the parachute regiment when I was 16. When I left school, I went to the Army Foundation College.
Oh, that's where I went. What year were you there?
2006. And then I done 52 weeks there, phase one training. Mm-hmm. Once I completed that, I went on to phase two in Catterick and done 16 weeks training there. On my first tour, I was only 19. Uh-huh. 2009, I was deployed out to Helmand, and halfway through my tour, I come back off R&R, and I'll always remember it. I landed on the 2nd of August, and then on the 4th of August, I was deploying down to a place called the Babaji, just forward of Fob Price. I'm sure you'll know that area quite well. This is a story that I've never really speak out about. I've always found it quite difficult to talk about it, because I never thought it affected me until now, really.
Right.
Until years later. But I was on an op, and we were to go down and support the Mercians, and what was it, Fob 9, I believe. PB9, they called it.
Yeah.
And it was just a couple of miles down the road from Fob Price. And we all were in the car park one day, and we were just chatting away. And we'd been warned that this route that we're going down is marked as a red route. Mm-hmm. So this route is heavily IED'd every day. However, their excuse for us to go down by vehicle rather than air was, well, we've cleared it in the morning and we've cleared it in the evening, sort of thing. And then we're like, okay, that's great. But what about from
between that,
what happens between that, you know? And I just remember being in the car park, and we were all chatting away amongst the lads and stuff. And one of the point vehicle commanders, Kev Mulligan, had said, I've got a really bad feeling about this. This isn't right. We shouldn't be going in mobile. We should be going in by air.
Yeah.
It just doesn't make sense. And it's such a strange story, because I'll never forget that conversation we had in the car park. Because Dale Hopkins as well, the other one who was hit, he turned around and said, yeah, I couldn't agree anymore. And I'm due to fly home next week to go on R&R. And then, oh no, actually, he was flying home to go on SB selection. So he was cutting his tour short to go on selection.
Yeah.
You know, to go and do what he, you know, dreamed of doing. Yeah. And then you had the other lad, Kyle Adams, lovely young boy, who was only 18, had just joined battalion and got flown out to do his first tour.
Buzzing.
I actually spoke to him on the boardwalk back at camp before we got to Fob Price.
Yeah.
And it was the only conversation me and him had. But he said, oh, you know, are you Roy from Mortars? I said, I am indeed, you know, nice to meet you. Mm-hmm. And he said, what's it like out there? And I said, well, it's my first tour, mate. You know, the first couple of months, I've been okay. Everyone's safe, put it that way. Mm. Very kinetic, you all know that. 2009 was very kinetic tour.
Yeah, massively.
And then he said, yeah, I can't wait to get out there. And so basically we all loaded the vehicles up, and point vehicle was Kev Mulligan, Dale Hopkins, Kyle Adams, and a bloke from Mortars called Troy Connor.
Mm-hmm.
Today he's alive and well, but he was the only one that survived in this incident. So as we go down this route, I was two vehicles behind.
Yeah.
And we come to a little junction on the road, and it come over the net. Right, we're just going to get out quickly, have a little look around the corner, do some op armour in, you know.
So op armour, for listeners that know, op armour is like a little operation we do when we get to a vulnerable area where we think there's IEDs, and we'll send the young guys out with the metal detectors.
We call them crow bags. We send the crow bags out, right? Who's been in the least amount of time? Who's not got their wings?
Right.
And who's a fucking turd?
You're looking for the IDs.
Get yourself out there. Get the vellum out and start fucking sweeping.
So they'll get the mine detector out and they'll reluctantly do their sweep. And they'll give the thumbs up, and then we put our fingers in our ears and then walk down. But
they get out, you know, they get ready to armour it, they kind of clear it, and everything's all good. So they get back in the vehicle, and they push forward, and literally about 3 seconds later, I'll never forget it. It was the most surreal experience. It was like everything had gone up in the air at a million miles an hour. You know how like an atomic bomb goes off and then the smoke and the cloud
the
goes up,
cloud.
Big mushroom cloud, but you don't hear anything.
Mm-hmm.
And then a few seconds later, boom, you hear it.
Mm-hmm.
And it was the loudest explosion I've ever heard. And I think when they had done the investigation on what had actually happened on that day, there was over 80 pounds worth of explosives dug under a bridge. Which they couldn't detect with the vellum.
Yeah.
It was huge. It was absolutely massive. And I'm just trying to think. This is the first time I've told this story.
I've
told it to friends and family, you know, close ones, things like that. But it's actually quite hard to speak about it. But I was only 19 at the time.
Yeah.
And this is a tragic, tragic event, you know. And it gone off, and I just remember seeing it and just being like, wow, has that just happened? Like, this is fucking epic. And then it was a contact straight after it. So we were in a full-on contact IED.
So was it a Taliban-initiated IED?
Yeah, it was basically done by command wire.
Yeah.
So they dug all the explosives under this bridge, 80 pounds worth in big white barrels, plastic barrels. It was basically designed to destroy a tank, I think.
Yeah,
but we were in MVs.
Huge.
Yeah, we were in MVs. So as soon as it happened, you know, the vehicle was split into two, and one part of the vehicle was like 50 meters to the right, and the other was just where it was, where it happened. And it was just unreal. Like, we were in a full-on firefight. We had to push forward. We had to win the firefight.
Yeah.
Whilst trying to drag these casualties out.
It's hard.
It's
fucking hard.
And I just always remember setting up my 81 mortar in the middle of the road, because we were going to call in mortars because the Apache wasn't here,
you know,
to give us the fire support straight away. And the lads kind of got out, dealt with the contact, and we had set up mortars. And I just remember someone screaming at me saying, you need to push forward and, you know, collect a casualty. Bear in mind, this is my first tour, you know, been in a few contacts, but nothing crazy, nothing too serious. I'd just come back from R&R, and, you know, I was picking up Kyle Adams off the floor, you know.
Yeah.
Putting him onto a stretcher, and I just looked at my mate, Tidder, and I said, like, is this happening? It was just crazy, you know. But then training kicks in, the adrenaline's running through, you're not really emotional.
Yeah, you're not there.
You're not there.
No.
You're just like...
Doing.
You're just doing your job.
Yeah.
So we got that casualty back. He sadly passed away on the way back to Bastion. Connor was treated at the same time as Kyle was by another two guys. He's alive and well. I actually spoke to...
That's good.
spoke to Troy the other week, a few weeks ago. He's doing really well. But Kyle and, sorry, Kev and Dale actually died at the scene. So, yeah.
Yeah.
And then it's
a massive loss.
It was a massive loss. It was a shock to us as a unit because it was the first, you know, real incident that had happened on ops in Afghanistan for a while, for, you know, for a few years, from what I can remember anyways. And then I was, once that had all brushed over and we had kind of got, you know, control of the situation and pushed the Taliban back, we were ordered to push forward to FOB 9 and support the Mercians, where I had to sit down there for 3 weeks, providing mortar fire support.
Yep.
And patrols as well. The guys went out, done their patrols. And the reason being was the Mercians had been absolutely smashed. They'd lost like 7 guys in one day. And that was the whole point of us going down there. But it was just the whole, like, it was almost like we knew it was going to happen.
Yeah.
With the conversation in the car park, Dale saying, oh, I don't feel well, I don't think this isn't right.
It's not right.
He was actually throwing up. Kev was shaking. He was bit sweaty, you know, and he was like, I'm not happy with this. Obviously, Kyle didn't really know any better because he was a new bloke. And Troy was just, you know, happy just to jump on the wagon, give extra top cover support.
Yeah.
You know, so again, it was almost like they knew it was going to happen. And it's something I'll never forget. I smoked 20 cigarettes that day, and I'm not a smoker. But at the time, I wasn't a smoker.
Yeah.
And I actually smoked 20 fags because I couldn't believe what had happened.
Yeah.
The tragedy, the fucking aftermath mess was unbelievable. Yeah,
not only that, like what was said prior to that as well, the fact that them boys said,
It was very scary.
I don't have a good feeling about this, and the fact that it fucking happened.
Yeah.
And yet you cracked on to the next, cracked on to the mission.
For 3 weeks. 3 weeks I sat in a FOB, mate, and I didn't do a lot at all, just that on my mind. And I remember the night I got in after it had happened, I picked up the satellite phone. I phoned my mum and my dad. Well, I tried to get through to my dad. I couldn't get through. But I spoke to my mum and I just said, I just want to let you know that I'm okay and I'm alive. But anyways, passing that, I thought I was fine.
Yeah.
You know, I dealt with everything fine. Yeah. I cracked on with the rest of the tour. There was a few other incidents.
Had you had R&R by then or not?
No, I'd already had my R&R. It was actually 4 days after I'd had my R&R.
Yeah.
And I went straight down onto this op, and then boom, that had happened. And I was, again, I was only young. I was 19 at the time.
Did you notice a change in yourself or not?
Nah, not point? Not really, because I just
it's really hard to notice a change in yourself because it's...
Yeah.
I think it takes years to notice a change.
If I'm brutally honest, right, I only noticed a change after my third tour.
Mm.
And this is when it started to eat me up big time. Mm. Like, I thought I was totally fine. I thought, yeah, I dealt with that situation, you know.
And that was the first tour, right?
That was my first tour, 2009. I'd been deployed to Afghanistan 2011 and 12, winter tour, with SFSG, and then I deployed in 2013 again with B Company, with SFSG. And when I come back later on in the year 2013, I was diagnosed with noise-induced hearing loss.
Fuck.
So basically,
was that down to the mortars or down the contacts to or
contacts, mortars, a bit of everything, you know? I think
in terms of equipment supplied by the military, like yourselves, like we got the pretty decent air defence, but it wasn't straight away.
No.
We didn't get it like when everyone else got it. We got, like, we probably got it after you lot, but we got it, like, the hand-me-downs.
Yeah.
And then the rest of the British Army got.
Well, what we had, we were issued Amplivox, reactive ear defence even.
Yeah.
Not Amplivox, they're fucking gash, they are.
The Pelter ones,
really good ones.
Electric.
The problem is, though, with them, is you still have to take them off to listen to what people are saying.
Mm-hmm.
You know, when you're in a full-on firefight, you can't always have these on.
The thing is, if gun one fires, and someone says at the same time, it blocks.
It blocks everything out,
So
at stages, you get caught out. even on training exercises.
And you can't afford that.
You can't afford to get caught out because then you end up having, like, hearing like an 85-year-old at the age of 29.
Well, like that, you end up killing your fucking boys.
Exactly.
You're putting them around the wrong place.
And that, yeah, that's probably more important. But, yeah, so I finished my third tour.
Yeah.
And this is when I started to notice changes in myself. I was downgraded for noise and just hearing loss. I was sat...
But before that, had... Did family and friends notice a difference in you or not?
Do you know what? It's really hard. I don't know. Because I think...
I did have family and friends say, are you okay, bro?
Yeah.
And I was like, yeah, I'm fucking fine. Are you okay?
I had a few wobbly moments where I come home after tour or I'd been away in the jungle or something like that. Yeah. And I'd come home and I got like completely minging and smashed up my mum's house. And she's just like, wow, my boy's home and he's just... torn the place apart, he's left the cooker on full whack and he's pissed all over the couch sort of thing. And he's a fucking hand grenade. Thank God there's only one of them here, because if all three of them are here, then I wouldn't have a house. I'd have to fucking live on the streets, because we're fucking... That's why all three of us don't get together, because we're a nightmare.
But I actually dealt with that with your brothers on their like on their previous returnings home.
Yeah.
Like, was that normal for her?
I totally get it. My mum, she's such a strong woman.
Because your brothers before you were Reg. It's
hard for her to tell any change because Kyle's been on multiple operations in Afghan. Sean done one tour of Afghan as well, and he come back unscathed. All three of us come back unscathed. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So I think it was hard for my mum to see any changes. She obviously knew that we'd been through a lot. And she definitely know in my situation, mm-hmm. you know, losing three guys in mm-hmm. one day, it wasn't a pretty sight to see. Mm-hmm. She knows that. But I think she thought at the time, oh, he's dealing with it quite well. Mm-hmm. He's okay. Mm-hmm. And this is just what parents do. They go out and get drunk every weekend. And
see, you're quite unique in the sense that you got two older brothers who were para-regiment.
Yeah.
Like for me, I was the oldest, so like my mum is like the first exposure of me of the British Army. I come home, like I kick off because she'd ordered like really thick bacon, and I tried to cut it, like slice it into bacon slices, and I couldn't, so I ended up stabbing it all over the kitchen, and she was watching it through the kitchen window and started crying because I was those fucking bacon going all over the kitchen. I'm just trying to visualize whether your mum had already experienced this with your brothers previously.
I think she'd experienced
so that when it came to you, she's like, that's just the
I think so, and it must have been hard for her because, you know, trying to open up to your sons who have gone through so much and who are in the parachute regiment, you know, she must have thought, oh, they're all right, they're dealing with everything okay, but yeah. But I hid a lot of stuff from my family. You know, I hid a lot of stuff. Mm-hmm. So after getting the news about being downgraded 2013, I found myself a bit lost mm-hmm. and helpless. Mm-hmm. I was then appointed being the support company armourer, and I was just in the armoury signing out weapons to the blokes
so
every
the
day.
So the lads doing shit.
Yeah.
That you were doing.
And the way I took my mind off it was just cracking fizz. I turned into a fizz freak. I was going to the gym all the time. Mm-hmm. I was doing circuits. I was just going a bit, you know, fizz crazy to keep my mind off what mm-hmm. had happened in the past. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And then I got the paperwork through to say that you will be getting discharged in 2016. And they gave me a date and everything. And it took nearly 2.5 years to go through this whole process.
The thing is, it makes it real when they get that.
When I get it in writing. Right. Yeah. And I got all this paperwork through and I was like, damn, I'm actually leaving. But then I got told that, oh, wait a minute. Why don't you do a PTI's course, go up to Catterick and be a PTI instructor? We might be able to do that for you. Mm-hmm. So I was like, brilliant. I'm not getting discharged anymore. So, and also my dream job, you know, I must say that I would have loved to gone up there.
I mean, for the listeners, PTI is like a physical training instructor.
Yeah.
So it's like you're really good looking guys at the gym who teach all these girls really weirdly how to do stretches. But in the army, it's these guys that go to the sunbeds, get their hair done really well.
And don't do any ops at all.
Yeah, and look really good in a vest.
Oh, and that's
so that's what PTI is.
So basically, I'm a renf. Being serious about that, that's exactly what I wanted to do. I would have loved to go up there to depot.
Yeah.
So here's me thinking I'm going up there to do my dream job. And then the army turn around and say, we're really sorry, but your medical records have been finalised and you're getting discharged.
Really? Even for PTI?
Yeah. Like they said, there's no going back. Things have been assigned through the CEO. Paperwork had gone to Glasgow. Wow. And it was like, I think it was because they were making cutbacks in the army. If you remember, a few years ago, they were just getting rid of people whenever they could.
Redundancies. Mm. And then they shot themselves in the foot.
Aye. And it's also, it's an insurance thing as well, I think. Right. I believe, like, they're covering their own asses these days. They're getting rid of people who aren't fully medically fit straight away, giving them a bit of money, and then see you later, and then not having to worry about it.
And then when you look into it, the small print says you can't sue for fucking hearing because you took redundancy.
Exactly.
Yeah.
That sort of thing. Well, for me, I was medically discharged, so I got a 22-year pension. Mm-hmm. It's not a Sergeant Major's pension. It's a full-screw pension, but it's better than nothing, you know?
Yeah.
So I get something back from it.
Yeah.
And you get a lump sum and things like that.
You're like £3 a week
for
the rest of your life.
There you go. Live on the freaking rations, corned beef gash and all that sort of stuff. But yeah, this part of my life is quite hard to talk about.
Yeah, well.
But I'd really like to talk about it because you've given me the opportunity to come here today. And I feel like this will do me a lot of good in my own head and be able to get it out there.
Let loose.
Because I know there'll be people out there struggling in maybe the same sort of field.
They can relate to it.
Can relate to it, yeah, yeah. So, yeah, so 2013, got the news, getting discharged. 2014-15, you know, on my weekends, all I was doing was going out, drinking.
Mm-hmm.
I just really felt lost. I had no purpose. Nothing was exciting me anymore. And I was like, what can I do to make my life more exciting? So, you know, I was a big betting man back in the day.
Yeah.
I say big, I'll come on to that. It's bloody massive. But yeah, I went down the route of gambling, which is a slippery slope.
Yeah.
I was not a lot. Nobody really knows. There's a few people that know, but I haven't really told anyone this story, but I feel like today it's the right time to speak about it.
Yeah, do it. It's the platform.
So, I got into gambling. Slowly but surely, I was in the casino, you know, once a week. And then it turned to twice a week, and then it was like every single day I was going into the casino, and nobody knew about it. You know, not even my past relationship.
What was it like, the chase of winning? Because
buzz, mate.
With addiction, like, My father was an alcoholic.
Yeah.
Dare I say it, I've probably teetered on the verge of being an alcoholic myself.
Yeah.
Just drinking to sleep.
Yeah.
Whether you class that as alcoholism, I don't know. But, or even just to function correctly.
For me, it was my
Would
way
you class of, it as addiction yourself?
It was not? An addiction, but it was a way of me getting away, not thinking about anything, being in company that didn't know me.
Yeah.
And I felt happy. Yourself. Yeah, yeah. And I felt happy in there. So I used to go to the casino and I was obviously winning money. That used to make me happy because I felt secure and safe. Whereas whenever I wasn't in there and I was just sitting in the block, I was very bored because remember, I'm getting discharged. I'm just in the armory. Yeah. I've got all the time in the world to do what I want.
And all the guys getting ready to go away and do things.
Yeah,
and
I was watching everyone.
The lads' operations and going away and fucking.
And you know, what come with gambling addiction was a lot of drinking to block out any thoughts, to forget about everything, i.e. the past, things that had happened on tour.
Yeah.
The adrenaline rush that I used to get off it. I've got a personality where if I sit still for a couple of minutes, I start to go mad. You know, I've got a very, like, I'm full of energy. Yeah. And I'm
Well, for the listeners that don't know, Roy and I have worked together for probably a good year.
Aye.
And it all start like we started working together in the south of France on a certain security job. where we were looking after a baby, weirdly enough. Like, not in, like, a Jimmy Savile way, but in, like, a proper security way.
Aye.
And then we sort of that job ended for 2 months. And then, weirdly enough, we ended up on the same job in London.
Yeah.
2 months later. And I was sat there and he walked in and we were like, what the fuck are you doing here? So that
and we've been friends ever since.
Yeah, and that's where our paths crossed again.
Yeah. And I tell you what, at that stage when you had met me in my life was a very rocky stage, I must admit.
So was the gambling part, was that still in you?
That was
in Nice?
That was still there. Going back to the gambling thing, it was a way of me escaping my past,
yeah,
and being in a nice, comfortable area where everyone was just like around each other, mm-hmm. their adrenaline was rushing, and I started to play a lot. I felt comfortable. So when I was winning this money, you know, I started to feel like a sense of, you know, mm-hmm. I'm great, mm-hmm. I'm awesome mm-hmm. again. Mm-hmm. Whereas when I wasn't doing that, I felt like shit. I was very lonely, even when I was with people.
The problem is that last time you felt like that was probably on tour, right?
Yeah.
You're on top of the world,
yeah,
doing the job you loved, doing something you loved,
yeah,
and it was rewarding.
Yeah.
And then, like, you were fucking hit with this massive fucking bombshell.
Yeah.
Of getting MD'd and, like...
And that's when it turned for me, you know?
Yeah.
So I was always going out. I liked to go to raves. I was meeting up with friends, like civvy friends, mm-hmm. and just going away doing things. I always found myself going back to the casino, and it got to the point where everything I earned was going into the gambling. I mean, I'd go weeks without eating, you know, just to place a bet, just to go in. It wasn't online, it wasn't in betting shops or anything like that. It was fully, like, I was into roulette.
Yeah.
In actual casinos, because that's where I felt at my happiest, you know?
Yeah. And chasing that drop.
Yeah, so it spiraled out of control. I lost £46,000 in one night.
Fucking hell. Yeah.
I went into a casino. I always remember it. I was heavily on drugs. Mm-hmm. I was coked out of my mind.
Yeah.
I hated my girlfriend. I didn't hate her. I loved her to pieces, but I hated myself for what I was becoming. Yeah. But I was too scared to reach out.
Sure.
You know?
Yeah, yeah.
And I had all this money. I'd been paid out from the army. My lump sum was come to about 45,000-46,000 or whatever. Had it all. I was gambling. You know, sometimes I'd win £5,000-6,000, and then other times I'd lose a few grand here and there.
Yeah.
And then one night I was absolutely off my face. I'd sat about, I had no job. I'd just left the boys in camp.
Yeah.
Said goodbye to everyone. And I just remember going into Cardiff one night to a casino called Le Croupier. And I was so intoxicated by alcohol and drugs, I can't even begin to tell you. I spent 2 days straight in there, but I can't remember a single thing. I just remember withdrawing 5,000 in chips, like, over the course of the night, and just putting huge bets down on the table. You know, just I just lost complete control, basically.
Yeah.
And I lost everything. I lost £46,000 in one night. And I honestly thought when I left that night, I thought, shit, I'm literally in a bad place. I'm in a dark place, you know? Like, what do I do? Where do I go? I went home. I seen my ex-girlfriend, Emma. You know, she's a great person.
Mm.
I was with Emma for 4 years. And she always knew from the start I had a serious gambling problem.
Yeah.
But she always put it down to what had happened
mm-hmm.
in the past. Mm-hmm. And I think I'm a firm believer in that as well. I believe that. I should have reached out for help when I got back off tour, and I should have seen the signs a little bit more, but I hid everything from everyone, you know? It was all a big secret.
You do.
It was a huge secret after I'd lost all my money.
Oh.
So yeah, I lost 46 grand in one night.
Rugby nights was obviously then, a good night.
Then I went back, I still had to pay rent with the missus, and told her, I said, I've lost all my money due to fucking my horrendous addiction. And
how'd you take that?
Do you know what? She was so used to it, mate, because I'd been gambling for
fuck
since 2012, 2013. Yeah, I was fully in the mix, you know. I was heavy gambler all the time. She just got used to it. she learned to cope with it. She loved me for who I was, which is a real shame because I had to leave her because it was killing her. It was absolutely breaking her. I used to have to phone her up, borrowing money. I used to tell her I haven't got money to pay rent this month. You know, the stress and the fucking sheer misery I put through that woman actually hurts me to this day because she's such a good person, you know. She's a great person. She deserves the world, you know. And sadly, her dad passed away this year. And I messaged her out of the blue, not her, one of her friends, just to pass a message on, sure, just to let her know I was thinking about her. And she really appreciated that. But yeah, I had to leave.
Is there any scope to?
No, I don't think so. Nah, but it's a real shame because I'm trying to find a stage in my life where I would be able to go and see her again to kind of open up and apologize.
Yeah.
To really just kind of, and I have apologized to her.
Yeah.
But I haven't been able to see her. You know, I haven't seen her for nearly 3 years.
Like a face-to-face and like a genuine apology.
Absolutely.
It is.
It means everything.
It means everything, but it's a credit to you as well.
Yeah.
In terms of being humble and say, look,
Hold your hands up.
I fucked up.
Yeah.
And I'm sorry.
And it's crazy because now I'm in a better place. I've been able to reflect on the past and go, wow, that's what I was doing and that's what I was like.
Mm.
That is not good. I was in a really, really bad place with addiction and just suffering with mental health in general. Like, I was depressed. I felt lonely all the time, even though I was around the lads. It was never good enough for me. Nothing was ever good enough.
It wouldn't be because you've been down, what they call downgraded.
Yeah.
Even that in the title alone, downgraded, is downgrading.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
So, like, fucking hell.
Yeah. It was a real shame because I got so used to being this gambler and going into the casino. It became a massive part of my life. It was like, this is who I am. This is what I'm going to do. And I accepted it, sort of thing. And hand on heart, now I can honestly say I've not gambled for just under a year.
It's brilliant.
Yeah, just under a year straight. But yes, there's a real...
There's gambling and then there's fucking gambling.
Yeah.
There's like putting a bet on football,
mm-hmm.
and then just putting all your fucking wage on a fighter to fucking win.
Well, to put it into perspective, some nights I'd go in, you know, I'd bet with a few grand, I'd get up to like 15, 20 grand, and I'd stick it all on the table all at once.
Fuck.
That's how serious it got.
Yeah.
I remember it was 2000 and... Oh, when was it? 2015, March 2015, I had won over £140,000. So I had £140,000 in my bank.
And that's where you should have...
But it was never good enough for me. I was always chasing the next hit. It was just because, oh, I can do this. I've won this money.
I'm fucking
invincible.
I can win it again.
I can do it again. And that's, you're in a really bad place
when
you're at that stage in your life with gambling. You need to seek help straight away. It doesn't matter who it is. But, you know, to cut a long story short, last year I ended up reaching out to my family.
Mm-hmm,
mm-hmm. I reached out to my mum first. I told her, I said, look, this is what I've been doing for years.
Mm-hmm.
You know, this is why me and Emma broke up. This is why I'm not happy and not nice to be around. I changed big time. I lost my identity completely.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
I used to be this really young, nice, friendly guy who used to just be full of energy, love going to the gym.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, I used to motivate everybody.
Good crap.
To this really selfish, horrible, sad, miserable guy who turned into a compulsive liar. I used to lie to go away to do my
gambling stuff.
Yeah. You know, God, the lies I used to tell Emma was ridiculous. I'm going to the shop to get a pint of milk, you know, we run out of milk, and I'd stream to the casino straight away.
Fuck.
That's how bad I was. And you're probably going to ask, where was the turning point in all this? When did I stop and why did I stop?
Yeah.
I've been to see psychiatrists. I've had counselling. I've had a mental health assessment at the start of this year. You know, I went through, I undergone all of that.
Mm-hmm.
And what it really come down to was absolute exhaustion of not having anything all the time.
Mm-hmm.
Everything mm-hmm. I had was just, I was throwing it away. The amount of money that I've spent in the past 6-7 years is absolutely frightening.
It's funny you say that because it's literally within the past 6 weeks where I've really looked at sort of my finances and what I've spent and how I spend my money.
Yeah.
Like, my biggest stress is financial stress.
Yeah.
Like, the biggest stress in my life is financial stress. And then I looked at the past 3 years, why have I had that financial stress? And it's literally through my own doing.
Yeah.
It's me doing it. No one else. It's not income. It's not the fact that I've had a really low income. I haven't had that in the past 3 years. It's how I spend my fucking money.
Yeah.
And I spend it like I'm a fucking asshole.
It's...
So I put myself in that stress.
It's crazy because this year I've learned so much about myself. Like, basically, because this problem becomes such a big problem in my life and I'd opened up to my family, which is the best thing I've ever done, by the way.
Yeah.
I've opened up to my mum, my dad, my sisters, my brothers.
Yeah.
I've reached out to my whole family just to say, this is what I've been doing. I can't take it anymore. I'm literally in a bad place. I need support.
Yeah.
So I got myself back up to Scotland. I hid away up there. My dad was giving me work. I was working on a building site with him on the Western Islands, you know, where you literally couldn't gamble, you know. it was like impossible.
Yeah.
For a start, there's no signal on that island. And you're literally stranded. So I was in a fucking sad state of affairs, mate, you know. But the best thing I ever done was open up to the family.
Yeah.
And my advice to anyone that's going through addiction, it doesn't have to be gambling. It could be drink, drugs, anything at all, is tell your family because they know you better than anyone on this earth.
Yeah.
You know, and if you don't open up to them and you open up to someone else, I don't think that's good enough.
No.
You need to face fucking reality ahead and tell your family. And as soon as you're honest with your family, you get this sense of relief.
Yeah.
Like when I told my mum what I'd been doing.
Hold yourself accountable for your actions.
Exactly. And it's funny you say that, right? I read a book start of this year, and everyone will probably know him, by a guy called David Goggins.
Mm-hmm.
And I was sat in my dad's house, I always remember it, and I was like, I need to get out of this rut. My headspace is fucked.
Yeah.
I'm feeling sorry for myself. I need motivation.
Yeah.
I've lost myself, my identity, everything that I used to be. I've lost it.
Mm-hmm.
I'm no longer this paratrooper anymore. I'm nothing. I feel like I'm absolutely nothing. How can I get this back? And I read his book, mate, and it is absolutely amazing. It's called Can't Hurt Me Now.
Mm-hmm.
No, it's called Can't Hurt Me. And he tells such an amazing story, mate. His words are so powerful, and I'm not going to bore you to death. However, I read this book, and I just thought, wow, this guy is absolutely amazing. So I started following him on Instagram, and then actually I come off social media. I had a break for 3 months, so I come off Facebook.
I remember. Yeah.
Instagram. Yeah. I come off all social media platforms. I carried on working with my dad.
Was that a recommendation in the book? Or
it was. It was like, whatever's distracting you in life, get rid of it.
Get rid.
Start focusing on yourself.
I like it.
Look yourself in the mirror and hold yourself accountable.
Yeah.
Accountable.
Yeah.
Exactly what you said there is what David Goggins says in his book.
Yeah.
Get a list. Get some fucking notes out. Start writing down your goals, future goals. Start pinning them up in the mirror and look yourself in the mirror every day and say, this is you. How can I fucking change it?
Fucking right.
So that's what I started doing. I started looking myself in the mirror and thinking, what the fuck are you doing with yourself? Why are you giving everything you work hard for in your life, absolutely everything I've earned, into the fucking casino?
Mm.
I started to realise that it was a waste of fucking time. I was wasting my time. It was hurting me mentally and physically. I had no energy to go to the gym because I was always thinking about numbers, always thinking about how much I could win, what I could do with that money and turn it into... It was exhausting, mate. I was exhausted. And I just turned into a miserable twat. So I started focusing on myself. Obviously, David Goggins, known for his ultra marathon running,
mm-hmm.
he said running's great therapy. So I started running, you know, once or twice a week, started building up, you know, to 3-4 times a week. And before you know it, I was running 3-4 half marathons a week. And I lost loads of weight. I was working with my dad on the site, 12-hour shifts. You know,
up here was brilliant.
Up here was starting to become a little bit more clearer.
Uh-huh.
And I thought, fuck, I haven't felt like this in a long time. But the best part about this story is because I told my family and got it off my chest, everything started to fall into place.
It was like a weight off your shoulders almost.
Weight off the shoulders. I had nothing to hide anymore. Mm-hmm. I'd been living this big mm-hmm. secret for mm-hmm. years.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, and at one point my mum was like, I haven't seen you for like 2 years and you've been hiding down Cardiff. What are you doing? I've met your girlfriend once who you've been with for 4 years. What is going on with Roy?
Mm.
You know?
Mm-hmm.
And everyone in the family was a bit concerned, but as soon as I opened up about it,
it made sense.
They were totally understanding. Mm-hmm. No one judged me, you know?
Mm-hmm.
No one asked me, oh, what's in your bank now? What are you doing with your money? Blah, blah, blah. They were just there to listen.
That's brilliant.
And this year has been a massive turning point in my life where I decided to come back down to London to get into private security. I jumped on a couple of jobs, you know, to get the money back in. And then I started landing some bigger jobs. I started networking, met up with the blokes again, and I was in a better mind space and I was more focused. I was not doing drugs. I wasn't drinking.
Mm-hmm.
All I could think about was just running, working, and paying my bills.
Mm-hmm.
And the more I started to notice with my bank having money in it again and paying my bills and being able to do things, the small things like go to the shop, get yourself some fucking food or jump on the tube. Or even if someone asked you, oh, mate, can you lend us 50 quid?
Yeah.
Giving that 50 quid to someone was like a dream come true to me.
Yeah.
Because I was like, fuck me, I'm in a good place.
Without worrying about it.
And it was a sense of relief, mate, and happiness.
Yeah.
And I just thought, I like feeling like this. And I just cracked on, mate. I put my head down and I am where I am now, mate. I'm looking at getting my own place just outside London, renting, obviously. I can't buy in London.
Well, no one can buy in London, let's face it.
Exactly. Nobody. You have to be, you know, billionaire. And, you know, I've got a car now. I can get from A to B. And it sounds silly, but
I used to
buy cars and I used to sell them because I used to get my money and I used to gamble it away again. So I've got a car now. I'm paying bills. I've got my phone up and running. I'm going out. I'm doing things. I'm just happier.
That's fucking brilliant, mate.
All because I was honest with myself and I opened up to my family.
It's being true to yourself and then holding yourself accountable.
Yeah.
That's what it's all about.
I just want people out there, if they're to take anything away from this today, from my story, is if you are going through gambling addiction, you need to hand over everything. Your phone, your fucking laptops, you need to bar yourself from all the sites.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Online, whether it be, even if you don't do online gambling.
Everything to your previous life, like stop and decease and then start again.
And start again. You need to literally block yourself off everything. And there are websites out there that you can do it on. There are people you can phone, helplines, mm-hmm. and they put your details through a system and then they make sure that you're barred from all these sites.
Mm-hmm.
You could do that as well. In casinos, you can phone them up. You can bar yourself within seconds. You know, it's part of law.
It's much like alcoholism, but it's more of a covert way because you can literally go to any pub you want. Any pub you want and just get a drink.
Yeah.
And be there and be Jack the fucking lad on the piss.
Yeah.
And you can do the same in any casino or even online now. You don't have to go there. You just literally sit at home.
And you know, I went down that road as well and it's just evil.
Mm.
You know, it really is. And before you know it, you're right in the mix. You know, whether you're making a lot of money or losing a lot of money, you're in a bad place because you have no control mm-hmm. over your life.
Mm-hmm.
So you need to seek help.
Mm-hmm.
And anyone that is struggling, they know where I am. They can pick up the phone me. Honestly, anything to do with gambling, there's nothing that I haven't done.
Yeah, definitely. You know? Well, this Warriors RV on Facebook, which is like a veterans, as you know, a veterans page on Facebook, and that's to do with any sort of issue, whether it be gambling, alcoholism, drug addiction, homelessness.
Because they all come together.
They all... it's all revolved around one illness, and that's addiction. And there's, you know, people can put any stigma they want on it. It's addiction, whether it's drug, alcoholism, or gambling, and it's something that we can solve together.
Yeah,
but you have to speak out, and otherwise, if you don't, then.
And honestly, it's taken me years. I knew I had a problem years ago, but it's only just taken me until about a year ago to open up about it, because it's such a big step.
Yeah.
It's hard. It's not easy, but you've just got to remember that your family know better. They know you better than anyone else. And by you being honest with them, you will feel better.
Mm-hmm.
You'll feel like you've closed the book and then you can restart again.
A new chapter.
Don't get me wrong. There are points where, you know, you think about the past, you think, oh, you want to go back, you want to do it. Addiction doesn't go away overnight,
no.
You know, especially gambling. Every day I think about gambling. Every single day I think about it. I don't do it, but I certainly think about it. Mm-hmm. And it's an ongoing battle.
Well, it's not that, like, when you get with guys and they talk about putting a bet on or talking a match or a fight.
Yeah.
And they talk the odds and you're just like, oh.
Yeah. You start to think more clearly, and when you start thinking more clearly and you're in a more healthier place in your mind, you can start making wiser decisions, and then just focus on things that are going to give back to you, man.
Yeah.
Not fucking take away from you.
Yeah.
What I found is I'm back in the gym again. You know, I'm training 4 or 5 times a week.
So you have positive feedback from that.
I'm feeling better. Once you start feeling better in yourself and seeing results and feeling healthier, you don't want to go away.
So that you gain respect from the family as well.
Yeah.
You're not doing it anymore. It's like a double positive feedback.
Exactly. For me, I just thought, do you know what? I need to fucking bounce back from this horrendous rut that I'm in. And all I could think about was just getting back down here, getting money in again, and start providing for myself, doing things for myself, not getting people to do things for me because I've lost everything.
Yeah.
You know, start fucking making yourself proud again. Start holding your head up and facing reality, you know.
100%.
Yeah.
100%.
So
that's the way forward.
That's so my story.
If you're struggling, thank you, brother. I really appreciate it. If you're struggling, jump on Warriors RV on Facebook. There's umpteen's amount of support there from guys who've been through all sorts of addictions. And if you literally just post an issue, and there will be someone on there to say, look, I've been in the same place. This is what I've done. This is where you need to go. And if not, then someone will be there to find you a place to get
And to. I am more than happy to hear other people's problems with gambling or anything. They can message me on Facebook. They can phone me. Honestly, like, nowadays what I want to do is start helping other people, you know, because I'm going through this journey still, but I want other people to know that if they're struggling, that I'm here and I'm happy to listen as well, like any other bloke would be, you know. You've got that Facebook page that's just opened up called Op Spartan.
Yeah, Op Spartan. Monkey and I spoke about before.
Yeah, that's just come up. That's really good. It seems to be quite effective. A lot of guys reaching out for help with PTSD or you know,
issues,
any sort of issues at all, whether you're breaking up with the missus or something like that. Guys are on there. They're happy to listen. You know, and before you know it, you could have someone at your door, you know, sat down with you.
With a possible job opportunity.
Exactly. Exactly, mate.
Roy, thank you, brother.
Mate, thanks very much for having me. It's been an absolute pleasure.